Mr. Palmer, Reel 11. We're talking about the lead-up to the crossing of the Tiano on the 28th of October, 1943, I think. And you were talking about how they moved up their headquarters close behind the crossing point, or they moved the headquarters up. And you were talking about Colonel Preston.
Yes.
And what he did.
Information was not coming soon. Obviously, there were people getting on to him live directly or indirectly about this, according to the two books and the report in the battalion history. But there were some pretty strong words said back at divisional headquarters. And I think Brigadier Block would have said to Hawks before going, you know, tell the question, things would be all right. Anyway, he wanted to get information. He knew that his company was not very far from him, but he couldn't understand why he hadn't heard. So, Lance Corporal Fernley and myself were sent to try and make contact. We had parcels with nobody able to do it. Well, we made contact all right, and the company's headquarters was within the house. At the other side of the wood, diagonally across from there. But of course, we had to move forward very quietly because, I mean, we didn't know what the situation was. Anyway, contact was made. We went back with our report, and also the company got in touch. What had happened, I do not know. I don't know. You would want one of the signal section to tell you whether they'd be unable to get through for some reason. Of course, as you would have found out in talking to Elliot, that the telephone, all this apparatus that they carried on their backs, tremendously heavy. It was an improvement upon, shall we say, telephone communication, that you could only get information back that way, and then wireless, of course, when it came in, these machines were good, but of course they could go wrong as well. You couldn't, somehow or other, something would have happened. Anyway, that was it, and the villagers, of course, were overjoyed. Everywhere we went, they were overjoyed.
How did you get on with the Italians? Because they were fighting on the other side. But
yeah,
while we
were in Italy, and while we were back at Salerno, I think he joined up with us, or just after, we got hold of an Italian lad who was a university student. And he had come back and he'd offered his services. Now, quite obviously, this was a tremendous advantage to the battalion to have someone who was Italian, could speak to an Italian, and wasn't just there to interrogate prisoners. He could go along and interrogate, and it was amazing, some of the wonderful billets that we had in the intelligence section, because we had. Just for a short time, we were very fortunate.
Do you remember this man's name?
No, I don't. I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you. I don't think it had appeared. It doesn't have appeared in any battalion records, but he was very useful to us, and he was useful to the whole lot because he could go along when advance parties went forward to take up new positions behind the line. This is what usually happened. You see, you would have to move forward, so there's always an advance party went. Maybe it'd been on one or two advance parties, but usually it was usually the sergeants who would go on the advance party, along with the officers, someone in the selected officers for that. And it would be their job to find billets and so on, requisition, how requisition can be carried out, how you can get transport through and so on, according to the situation.
When you got these billets, would you treat them with respect, in the sense that they were...
Yes, we didn't go about smashing the place up. I'm not saying that applies to everybody, but I mean, one thing about the people in the I section, there were only a few of us, and of course you could easily deal with anybody that got open. We were actually very fortunate in a way with that.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then? There's a crossing of the Tiano, and then what follows on from there, as far as you remember?
After Tiano, we moved up to the next place, which was, I think, Monte Camino. And this was a very difficult part of the mountain range, too, because Monte Camino was the last mountain, if you like, before you came to Casino. And the river Garigliano ran away on our left, and the river Leary ran across the front, and yet there were these mountains to conquer as well, or mountains all round. So of course this was Italy. It was one hill after another. It had been rather like that in North Africa, but not quite so extensively, because that part from Naples up to Rome really was mountainous, and then you come into the area of the Apennines, which made it difficult to get anywhere without really having to have some rather nasty battles in order to do it. And when we moved up to this place, this is where we had a marvellous village in the little village in which we were stationed, facing Monte Camino. And I used to periodically get shelled. And one day, I'd been on an observation post. This is a bit I remember particularly about that part, because the company has taken Calabrito, or was holding Calabrito, and not necessarily taken it. And then of course they were coming under constant attack, and they were losing a lot of men, and the situation was no better anywhere else really. But various little attacks had come in, and they'd been unsuccessful. And so it was necessary to try and find out what the strength of the enemy was, and to get a sight of Camino itself, the forward slope anyway. And I was out on this observation post one day, and what we were looking for on the opposite side of the hill was for any movement there, and hazy sunshine. Hazy because of the heat of the day, very often it was very difficult to spot anything. And if you had an observation post, well and good if you were in some kind of shelter. And we were on this raised up platform, which I think was part of some outbuildings on one side of the road. And we were looking across, and looking at the road, suddenly I saw some movement across to the left. Almost simultaneously, they were three members of the Cheshire Regiment. Now they were a machine gun battalion. And these three fellows had been, that's presumably who they were, they dashed across this open bit of ground, tore around, clambered over a gate, and obviously seen something that made them move with some haste. And while this was going on, I was looking out with the binoculars, and I spotted this fellow standing up on the hill in front, and it was obvious he wasn't a British soldier, and he was staring around, and he got men with him, and he was looking all over the place, and so of course we were able to send back a report about this. Not that we would have brought down fire, because in a way it was rather useful if you could retaliate in this way. If you had patrols that were working, let them get so far, if they were really a menace, all right, it might be necessary to call down fire on them, but otherwise you let them get on with it. But anyway, the report had to go through to company and to battalion and probably to brigade as well, that there was this movement going on here. Well, eventually they withdrew, but I had them in the sights. And to be perfectly frank with you, in all the time that I was on observation post, apart from Major Vitzig at Green Hill, who deliberately stood out on the top of the room just to say, go on, shoot. That was the first time I'd seen any part of the enemy. Heard them, yes, heard the tractors, and so on. But what you particularly listen for, this is not necessarily connected just with this, but you listen for their tanks. Because the Tiger tanks, I think, were better than ours. They were not only mobile, they were very heavy, but they were noisy. They were terribly noisy, but what they did at the time of the Volturno crossing, and I can remember the fact that when I was there, the tank going backwards and forwards, and you've got to get a new map reference, you've got to work it out, because you can only do it when he fires at night. Then you get busy doing that. In the meantime, he's moving to another position. And of course, the Germans used their used their compass and their troops extremely well. I mean, they were, from what we knew of them, they were crack troops.
In what way, what was so noticeably good about their tactics?
What was so noticeably good? That they were able to keep themselves out of vision very considerably. They knew that they had all this business, for instance, after an attack and they were pushed back. Their regrouping was remarkable. It was so good that, for instance, when an advance could have been made and pushed on further, you see, once you get the enemy on the run, that's fine, but you never. You didn't often get the Germans on the run. There was the occasion after Monte Camino, which would come a little bit later. They did go back with some degree of disorganisation after this, but it wasn't appreciated. It wasn't known about. So eventually, actually, the attack had to go on by Monte Camino.
Did you watch it?
We were in it. What happened was, again, one or two frontal assaults had been made. No relief had come from our company. You couldn't move across to them very easily to resource it. They were right under the German noses, and they had a very sticky time of it. And, of course, Major Barents was killed there. Now, he was one of the finest officers you could have.
What was Barents like?
What was he like?
Yeah, as a person or anything about him.
I would not have said necessarily a very chatty or talkative kind of individual, but he was marvellous to his men. They had infinite faith in him. At one time, he was Major Barents helped, of course, as HMA. He was one of the only officers of the battalion. And I remember when he was at Sydney. When I was there, he was a lieutenant, I think, or second lieutenant, even.
And he made a good impression on you then?
Made a good impression. Anyway, he was doing what he had to do there, but it was a case of his company was suffering, and then once he did, things were different. And it was decided, this was not just a battalion idea, this was worked out by division, that what would happen was an attack would be made to go round the side and come over the back. Again, a repetition, you see, of this, which had been done in North Africa as well, come round the back and take the enemy by surprise. So I remember this particular night, we moved up behind the guns, and the amount of fire that was put in them from the 25 pounders and the heavier stuff, tremendous barrage. Well, you see, the Germans used to come through this sort of thing. When we get on to the casino, I mean, we'll be able to mention that to you again. It was tremendous. Anyway, we moved over in the early hours of the morning. Already there had been something of an attack there, or there had been people who tried and failed because there were one or two bodies still lying about, but I don't think it was from that period. So we moved forward, and by daylight we got into the position behind where B Company was, and the guards were behind us, apart from our company, rifle companies going through. Once we got through, then the grenadiers, not the grenadiers, the coasters came through there, and we were there for a little bit in this position.
So you'd be moving forward with battalion headquarters, you wouldn't be attached to an infantry platoon or anything?
No, we were moving forward with battalion headquarters.
And ready to take up your duties as necessary.
Yes. But it was the guards that followed through after us in open formation. They came through in daylight, you see, then. But we moved at night. I'm not suggesting for one minute that the guards liked to do something and show how what brilliant troops they were. They were good without all that. But they certainly always, if you had in support, didn't matter where it was, if you had a Scots Guards, another guard, I can remember on one occasion a Scots Guard sergeant. One of his men had been wounded, and he wanted to get him out of the way, and the Germans were still firing on him. He was waving his flag. And he was waving his flag, and eventually, of course, the Germans stopped firing. Their machine gun fire stopped. But while we were here, the advance was going in from there, the guards were going through, you see, the positions there, and we were moving forward as well. We moved down into this particular lane, and as we were going down, the Germans fired, and one of the section, the chap who joined us at Salerno, the one I mentioned before, he got wounded in the leg. At least I think that's what it was. I don't know what. I don't actually know what happened.
Do you mean the Italian one? Sorry.
No. When I said the chap who joined us, I meant the British soldier, not the Italian gentleman. The firing was going on over our heads, and we just stopped there for a bit and waited for that to stop. I think we brewed up some tea, but we were all right, you see. And then when we moved back to the village, we were taken to another village near there.
You don't know the name of the village?
No, wait a minute. No, carry on, I'm being too quick. We were moved up from there, and we were moved up closer to Casino. again at night, and we had two of the intelligence section went forward with the Americans. The idea being, of course, that they would bring back a certain amount of intelligence about that, so that we moved back in reserve, and the first battle in Casino took place shortly after this particular occasion. Once Camino had been captured, you see, but what we didn't realise was that if we'd followed through then, we'd have come round the side of Casino, which of course is what eventually did happen. The Casino, in a sense, was never really taken, not in an out-and-out pitched battle. Anyway, we were moved to the side. We were moved more to the east, and then up to the west, more or less astride the main road, but we were taken up to this particular spot, and we were supposed to wait there before we crossed or attempted to cross any river. However, the American attack was unsuccessful. And it was round about this time that I cannot again give you any precise details on this score as to whether it was before the American attack went in. I think it probably was. I was up on an artillery observation post, and I watched the planes come over, our planes, in close formation, and they dropped their bombs. I don't remember ever seeing, I don't think they used, as we always used to use, someone guiding them in. They came straight over, they dropped their bombs wave after wave, and of course you could see the smoke and the hold of the Casino beginning to go up in the air. Brickwork being shattered and the rest of it, and I thought, oh yeah. But of course it didn't make any difference. The Germans were there for a long time. That battle for Casino went on intermittently after the Americans had been in. There were three other attempts. The New Zealand division, there was the 4th Indian Division, I don't know in which order that quite that came at the moment, and the last, of course, was the Polish Division. Now, it was the Polish Division that eventually took Casino, but that by that time, they'd worked round from the flanks, particularly the French Division that had worked round there, and the rest of the American 5th Army had moved round. But it was while after the Americans had attacked, I think it was very shortly after that, we moved back to prepare to cross the Garigliano. And it was at that particular point that I wrote these accounts of the Volturno and the Tiano battle.
What did you use to write them? I mean, were they based on the war diary?
They were based upon the various reports from battalion, from the company commanders, that they would send in their reports, and he would use these, and he would also use what else he gathered. And of course, as being a member of the intelligence section, you gather some very useful information from them. If you would want to know their point of view as well. You used anyway, you used the information that was placed in front of you. And it's very like all these things, you had to put it together, piece it together, and send it in. As I said, Major Johnson had already written his account, didn't he?
Now, during this long period of fighting, you mentioned earlier you got to know Preston quite well. Are there any illustrations of that?
Well, I mentioned one illustration of that where we went out after the crossing of the Tiano, and he approached Fernley and myself. But I mean, we could always go and chat with him. In fact, I'd written a poem about, not just about the battles, but generally after the Battle of Salerno, which is perhaps the soldier's thoughts in peace when you're not actually fighting. And Colonel Preston had specially, it was sent to division, they put a magazine, and it was put in the divisional magazine. That actually I sent home to my father, and he got it published in the Poetry Review. So, I don't think it was terribly good, I've still got it somewhere.
Well, we've looked that out now, and you're going to have a bash at reading it for us, if that's very kind of you.
You and the aftermath. Mud-grimed men, black with the soil of Italian fields. What will you say when the day of reckoning comes? You who touch the threads of fate and gamble gaily with an eager, merciless destiny clutching your rich life. A stake for a game played with hell's cards. When the game is over and the ghastly light pales into the darkened aftermath, will you see the light of morning overcast its softening rays across the world's threshold? The first new clean caress? Or will you see the wreckage of a pack of cards strewn across the table's length in mad confusion? All that remains in a world of ill-lit rooms and tables set for an earth's ruin. You and you alone clutch the key opening the door, a great door, a door that opens on a lighter room, full of windows, welcoming well the light of day and catching the moon's touch, the richer mysteries of this world's light, its shadows and its gleams. Those who never knew life's chilling darkness, the depths of man's despair, cannot know the cherished wish that lingers in his soul for the magic light of glorious peace, streaming through the open windows, clean and bright. There are many still in England, munition workers who live under the cloudiness of war, feeling no death's grip, are content to live in gloriously, gathering the dirty riches of the gambler's table, clutching for more, discontented with their fortune. How can men such as these live in the light again, unless the ardent soldier, knowing what he wants, turns them with his visions from their unrealized lives?
And that's what you wrote after Salerno.
Yes.
Did you feel pretty badly about profiteering munitions workers and things like that at the time?
We did. We all, probably unfairly, but we did, yes. We thought that somehow that there's a great deal of difference between making munitions at home and being in the front line. It's unfair in a way because the civilian population of the country did suffer in the war.
But that's how you felt then?
That's how I felt. I hope it doesn't sound from that somehow or other I was bitter. I think it was mainly an observation. It was not intended to be, shall we, savage in any way.